Here comes Carr, steps back. Now he comes up, going to fire again. Left side, going for it. Ruggs. Ruggs has got it. Touchdown. Jackpot, baby. Vegas touchdown. Vegas touchdown. Jackpot. And away.
That was the final Raiders touchdown of the day and the end of the Jets' hopes for their first win of the season. Sunday's best football was played by some of the NFL's worst teams, and Bill Barnwell takes a magnifying glass to all the chaos. We look at who got redeemed, who did not, and the complex playoff picture now taking shape. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, December 7th. This is ESPN Daily. So, Bill, it is 11:38 p.m. Eastern. We just finished watching this Broncos-Chiefs game, and the Broncos, to their credit, kept it surprisingly close pretty much all night, losing just 22-16. So, before we get into everything else that happened today, and it was so much, what did this game teach you about Kansas City?
I think it was just a reminder of how hard it is for a bad to mediocre football team to beat the Chiefs.
Bill Barnwell is the host of the Bill Barnwell Show podcast, a gentleman and an NFL scholar.
And in so many cases on Sunday, we saw, you know, maybe mediocre teams have great games. The Broncos kind of did almost everything you would ask for if you wanted to build a blueprint for how to beat the Chiefs as a significant underdog. I mean, they forced the Chiefs to struggle in the red zone, where they kicked four field goals, only scored one touchdown, I think a 20-yarder to Travis Kelce. The Broncos ran for 179 yards. They controlled the clock, controlled the football. There was that weird stuff with Tyreek Hill, where he had one long touchdown called back for holding, and then a second touchdown where he apparently caught the ball, didn't realize he had caught the ball, walked off the field like he hadn't caught the ball, did enough with his body language to convince Andy Reid to not even pay attention to the replays, and then had Andy Reid punt before, but also the Chiefs like running onto the field like they were excited to punt the ball away, to punt and deny them the opportunity to challenge what was a pretty obvious touchdown on review.
Bill, Tyreek Hill, who attempted a backflip on the other touchdown that got called back.
Yes.
This is the last person I would have yelled at my TV saying, why didn't you know that you scored on that play?
Receivers' aptitude for suggesting that something that was not ruled a catch on the field was in fact a catch is not always great, Pablo. This was the first time I have seen the opposite, where a receiver unknowingly caught a touchdown pass and seemed to not really be interested in having caught that pass or the possibility of having caught that pass. So the Chiefs did all of that. The Broncos had all of that in their favor. They needed one more thing to kind of wrap everything up, and they didn't do that. That's just they lost the turnover battle, Pablo. The only two giveaways in this game were both Broncos giveaways, one on the first drive of the game and one on the final drive of the game for Drew Lock. For a bad team to beat the Chiefs, even if you get all those other things right, even if you have a touchdown somehow inexplicably go in your favor, you need to win the turnover battle. And because the Broncos didn't do that, they were not able to pull the upset, finish the job, and beat the Chiefs.
All right, Bill. Honestly, this is true. I honestly don't know if I've laughed as hard as I did during this sporting event all year. And it's because the New York Jets came so close. They came closer than they have all season to earning that first win of the year. And then fate, or something hilariously like fate, ended up intervening. So how would you begin to explain what the hell happened here?
Okay. So to understand how the Jets blew this game, Pablo, we have to set the scene a bit. Because you have to consider the existence of Jets defensive coordinator Greg Williams. Now, we've talked a lot about Adam Gase on this show, and with good reason. But Greg Williams is maybe most famous for his role in the Saints' Bountygate scandal a few years ago. He's made his name around the NFL as a good to mediocre, blitz-happy, hyper-aggressive defensive coordinator. If I had to sum up Greg Williams in one sentence, it's that there's never been a problem he saw that couldn't be solved with more blitzes. So, in this game, we saw what happens when Greg Williams is in situations where the Jets need to stop. On the prior drive, before the infamous drive we'll get to in a moment, the Jets sent a big blitz on 4th and 8 and left safety Marcus May one-on-one against Darren Waller. That's a bad matchup under any circumstance, but Darren Waller was in the middle of a 200-yard game. May held Waller and let his feelings be known after the game.
Marcus, when that call comes in, even before the snap, are you thinking to yourself that that's not a good call there? I mean, just because of the situation? I mean, I know that's happening so fast, but...
Everything is happening fast for me. The call came in, a lot of, things running through our minds and everything like that. So, we just played the call that the coaches called and, and we just got to execute, but you got to help us out at the same time, just being the better call at that spot.
Then, on 4th and 3 from the 9-yard line, after offsetting penalties wiped away a touchdown, Williams sent a 7-man blitz, left no safety help for his defenders, and forced an incompletion. Greg Williams, perhaps buoyed by his success, filed that one away for future reference. So, Jets went 3 and out, handed the ball back to the Raiders with 35 seconds left. They allowed a quick completion to Waller, and then, after a spike, the Raiders had 2 plays. On the first play, the Jets actually played things pretty conservatively. It didn't matter. Nelson Aguilar still somehow got open deep for what would have been a game-winning touchdown, only for Derek Carr to overthrow him. This triggered Greg Williams. He knew if I sent big blitz earlier and big blitz worked, and I didn't send big blitz now and we almost lost, I must send big blitz. So, with 7 seconds left, he went back to his instincts and went with big blitz. He wanted to end the game with a kill shot. Greg Williams sent 7 men after the quarterback and had an 8th defender, I would say inexplicably, spying Derek Carr for some reason, leaving the Jets with 3 men in coverage against 3 receivers. One of those defenders, Pablo, was an undrafted rookie cornerback by the curious name of Lamar Jackson, who was up against superstar college player and first-round pick Henry Ruggs.
He's so fast. That's all I know about Henry Ruggs. He's so fast.
Pablo, he is fast. And the only thing you can do, the only thing you can't do in that situation is fall for a double move and let this very fast man get behind you for the game-winning touchdown. Lamar Jackson fell for a double move and let Henry Ruggs get behind him for the game-winning touchdown.
And both Carr and Ruggs, and this is where the comedy just continues, they both seemed incredibly surprised by this, Bill. And they basically said as much after the game.
You know, with 7 seconds left, I couldn't believe they all out blitzed us. But as soon as I saw it, man, I was thankful.
Henry, were you surprised to see them bring the house and leave you one-on-one like that with no hope over the top in that situation?
You kind of surprised that they brought the house like that and not to drop everybody back.
So, Bill, I now have to ask the question here, a question that I think everybody is asking, because it's no secret that Trevor Lawrence might be the number one overall pick in April. So is it possible that Greg Williams actually was in on this, that he did this on purpose? Is it possible that this was an inside job?
I would love to tell you yes, but I don't think the Jets and Williams are deliberately tanking. And the reason why is because we had this same exact discussion a little over a year ago at the Miami Dolphins when they sent an 8-man blitz and blew a 3-man man coverage behind to produce a 3rd and long touchdown on national television. And a conversation after the game was that the Dolphins coaching staff must have been in on the tank. Obviously, that was not the case. At the same time, being a competent coach or coordinator, for that matter, means understanding game situations and using your personnel to give your team the best chance of winning. The Jets, perhaps unsurprisingly, did absolutely none of that when the game was on the line against the Raiders on Sunday.
So what should Adam Gase be doing for the rest of this season then, for the good of the Jets?
This is an interesting question. I will say, I think the most important thing Adam Gase can do would be to sort of try and get the best out of Sam Darnold. I know Adam Gase said this week that's not something he's very good at, but you'd figure if the Jets are going to draft Trevor Lawrence and trade Sam Darnold, the best thing they can do is get him some nice tape over the final few weeks of the year to increase his trade value.
So let's pivot from the Jets to the Browns. The team I was most impressed by all day, Bill, is the team that also seemed so much worse than their record entering Sunday. And now I feel like I officially owe the Browns an apology. Because I don't know if I've seen Cleveland or Baker Mayfield play better than they did against the Titans today, beating them 41-35. Baker had 5 touchdown passes, 334 yards passing, and he has endured months and years now of mockery. So has Baker Mayfield officially redeemed himself?
I don't think so. I think, honestly, what we're seeing here is what Baker Mayfield can do against the AFC South. I mean, last week, Mayfield threw for 258 yards and 2 scores against the Jaguars, who are the second worst pass defense in the league by Football Outsiders' DVOA efficiency statistic. This week, Mayfield was dominant against Tennessee, but the Titans had a critical weakness coming into this game. The Browns, with their run-heavy approach, are one of the 5 most play-action-heavy teams in all of football. And coming into this game, Tennessee ranked 31st in QBR allowed against play-action pass attempts. Well, Pablo, you wouldn't believe what happened. Baker Mayfield torched the Titans off of play action. He was 9 of 10 for 173 yards and 3 touchdowns off of play action, including his 75-yard touchdown pass to Donovan Peoples-Jones.
Mayfield from under center, play action fake, bootlegs it out to the right. He's throwing down the right sideline. He's got Peoples-Jones wide open. He's gone. 20, 10, 5, touchdown!
If Baker can do this against the Ravens next Monday, that's a different story. I'll be watching closely, but I'm still very skeptical about Baker Mayfield.
So now Cleveland is 9-3, Bill, and those Baker Mayfield commercials, they suddenly seem a lot less like the advertising equivalent of those pre-printed Super Bowl t-shirts that get donated overseas. So the question in the bigger picture is whether it's time to buy into Browns mania. How far can this particular team go?
I mean, this was the most impressive performance of the season to me, by far, for the Cleveland Browns. I have to admit, I'm still not sure I'm on this bandwagon. Cleveland is 9-3, but do a modicum of work and take a closer look at those wins. They're 3-0 against the NFC East. They're 2-0 against the Bengals, who might be the long-lost cousin of the NFC East. They beat the Jaguars and the Texans by a combined 5 points. Cleveland's 2 most impressive victories are a 9-point win over the Colts and this win over Tennessee, which was a blowout, but got closer based on a couple scores in garbage time. On the other hand, the Browns' 3 losses, which are the Raiders, the Ravens, and the Steelers, 3 playoff teams, most likely in the AFC, by a combined 73 points. But most of the teams the Browns have beat this year aren't going to be around to beat up on come January.
So let's circle back to teams we can pick on, because other than the Jets in this Trevor Lawrence sweepstakes, we have the Jacksonville Jaguars. And the Jags were sniffing around an upset on Sunday, ultimately losing to the Vikings in a painfully long overtime. So they're also absolutely still in it for that number one overall pick. And considering, Bill, that we got some of the best football of the day from the Jets and the Jaguars, what does this say to you about the weirdness of the season we're watching?
I think it just tells us how much of an endless garbage palette we have for football. I mean, every few years, Pablo, there's articles about how there's no good quarterbacks left, or the quality of football has gone down, how it's embarrassing relative to what it was like in the good old days. It's nonsense. We don't understand what's happening on Sunday in most cases. In week 12, we saw a wide receiver who hadn't played quarterback in years play the position with one day's notice. We saw our Ravens team, wracked by COVID, play in the middle of a Wednesday afternoon. We were entranced. The end of the Vikings-Jags game was fascinating. It was so much fun. It was an incredible series of bad decisions, and the bad decisions were by the Vikings, not the Jaguars. And this isn't the team that's tanking. The Vikings are actually in the wild card race. There's really 6, 7, maybe 8 teams in the NFL right now who have any idea what they're doing, and then 24 teams that are just only out there to be chaotic and entertaining in the final 5 minutes of Red Zone at 4:15 and 7:30 on Sundays.
All right, Bill, coming up, I want to talk to you about the other chaos that was going on around the league on Sunday, like Jalen Hurts appearing out of the mists to take over in Philly. And I also want to explore the expanded playoff picture.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
So, Bill, the very simple fact that the Packers destroyed the Eagles 30-16 is not remarkable. Mm-hmm. But this game was a seismic event in Philadelphia because early in the third quarter, Carson Wentz finally got benched for Jalen Hurts, who may or may not now be the new starting quarterback of these three 8-1 Eagles. So what did the Jalen Hurts era, the beginning of it, Bill, look like to you?
It was weird. It was the most anticlimactic benching of a franchise quarterback I think I've ever seen. Hurts came in for a first down in the third quarter, and he's come in for snaps here and there, but then he never came out. He picked up a third and short with a beautiful 34-yard pass to Jalen Reagor, and then it was pretty clear this wasn't just a play or a series. It was clear he was not coming out of the game. He played every snap from that point forward.
Let's see what they do here. You know, the throwing.
He converted a 4th-and-18 with a beautiful touchdown pass to Greg Ward.
He's rolling. He's looking. He puts it in the air. Touchdown, Greg Ward! What a throw and what a catch!
And then a Reagor punt return got the Eagles back within one score. The Eagles actually had a chance to drive for a game-winning touchdown with Jalen Hurts at quarterback. It didn't go well, but for a brief moment, it actually seemed like Jalen Hurts was going to lead a moribund, downtrodden, overwhelmed Philadelphia Eagles team to a brief moment of excitement.
So should the Hurts era for this moribund Eagles team continue?
It's complicated. There was a lot to like here. I mean, Hurts made a pair of great deep throws, which Carson Wentz has not done very much of this year. He was effective as a scrambler. Carson Wentz has not been effective really as a scrambler. I'm not sure the Eagles really trust Hurts enough to run a full playbook yet. At the same time, let's be realistic here. We've seen the Saints win with Taysom Hill at quarterback. Hill was good on Sunday. We've seen them win with a limited playbook and limited quarterback play. Carson Wentz was 6 of 15 for 79 yards with 4 sacks before being benched. Nobody needs to see that again. It's pretty clear defenses facing the Eagles have no problem flummoxing Wentz. So the Eagles are actually facing Taysom Hill and the Saints this upcoming week. At the very least, I think Jalen Hurts presents a different set of problems for an opposing defense to solve. The Saints have an incredible defense. They're playing out of their minds right now. I would rather go with the unknown than the known, given what little we've seen out of Carson Wentz so far this season.
So moving over to the NFC West now, Bill, which is even more wide open after the Rams beat the Cardinals on Sunday, 38-28, improving to 8-4, which means that LA narrowly leads the division just ahead of 8-4 Seattle. But I am mostly curious here about Arizona. How worried should we be about Kyler Murray?
Let's start with Kyler. And this offense is struggling right now. Through the end of week 11, the Cardinals had 19 plays which gained 30 yards or more, the third highest total in the league. Over the last 2 weeks, they have won. It was on the opening drive of the game against the Rams on Sunday with an absolutely, totally, horrifically blown coverage from the Rams, where the Rams did all of the work and Kyler Murray just had to drop the ball into Dan Arnold for an easy 59-yard touchdown. He's been on the injury report with the shoulder issue. And in watching him play, it does seem like his shoulder is not 100%. Early in the game against the Rams, he was really struggling with his velocity and accuracy. After that 59-yard completion, he was only 2 of 9 on his next 9 passes for 14 yards. And a number of those throws were misses from Kyler. The Cardinals did go to more quick game in the second half, and Murray was having more success and seemed to have more zip on his ball in the second half. the lack of any sort of big play threat led the Rams to sit on routes at the sticks and led to that pick six in the fourth quarter, which ended up sealing the game. And on top of all that, whether it's the shoulder injury, whether it's something else, the defense maybe, Murray hasn't been running as much. Through that game against the Bills that ended with that incredible Hail Mary, Murray had been a devastating runner. He was averaging 67 rushing yards per game and more than one rushing touchdown per contest. He had 10 rushing touchdowns in 9 games. Over the last 3 weeks, no rushing touchdowns, and he's totaled 61 yards. So that part of the Arizona attack that seemed like it was always built in, that Kyler was always going to get his rushing yards, hasn't been there. In prior weeks, Murray was able to bail out whatever weaknesses his team had with great play on the ground and through the air. Without Murray playing at an MVP level, the Cardinals look pretty ordinary.
It does seem, Bill, like the good news for the Rams and Cardinals is that this game of postseason musical chairs at the very least has more chairs this season. Because for the first time, we have 3 wildcard teams per conference, which means we have a total of 14 total teams that are going to be in the playoffs. So I want to look at the very, very top of the standings now, because in the NFC, we have the Saints who clinched a spot in the playoffs on Sunday. And in the AFC, we have the Steelers who could do the same on Monday. So what is special? What is extra special about being a one seed in this particular year?
You get a vacation. You're the only 2 teams who actually get a vacation in the NFL. So the NFL expanded their playoffs and added a 7th team to each of the 2 conferences this year for the postseason. In doing so, they eliminated the bye week for the 2nd seeded team, which that's been pretty significant over the last couple of years. I mean, in 2018, the Patriots were the 2nd seed in the AFC and won the Super Bowl. In 2019, the Chiefs were the 2nd seed in the AFC. They won the Super Bowl. Both those teams enjoyed a week off that they're not going to get if they're the 2nd seed in the playoffs come 2020. Now, as a result, since the top seeded team in each conference is the only team that gets that first round bye, finishing with the top seed is more important than ever before. Chase Stewart of Football Perspective ran a study on this before the season and found that the typical top seed's chances of making it to the Super Bowl rose by 5 percentage points as a result of this change. The 2nd seed's chances fell by more than 11 percentage points by virtue of not having that first round bye. The Saints-Chiefs game in 2 weeks is going to go a long way in deciding who ends up with those top seeds in both the AFC and the NFC. And that means more than it ever has before.
Monday's late game, Bill, is going to be very strange for Buffalo. They're returning to Arizona, where they got traumatized famously by Kyler Murray and DeAndre Hopkins last month. Except they're going to be playing San Francisco, who is 5-6 after relocating there after Santa Clara County banned sporting events due to this whole pandemic thing. So does this game have the makings of just another Bills heartbreaker?
I do like the idea of every team relocating their games against the Bills to Arizona just to scare them. I think it depends on which version of the 49ers defense shows up. Because last year, the Niners defense really thrived on takeaways. But owing to randomness and a dramatic stream of injuries, let's be honest with the Niners, they only had 10 takeaways through their first 9 games of the season. Well, over the last 2 weeks, they've gotten guys like Richard Sherman back, and the Niners have forced 6 takeaways over the last 2 games, including, I believe, 4 against Jared Goff a week ago. Now, at the same time, the Bills and Josh Allen have turned things around after having some turnover issues more in 2018 than 2019, but after 11 giveaways over their first 9 games, the Bills have turned the ball over 5 times over their last 2 games. So if those trends keep up and the Niners are forcing a bunch of takeaways and the Bills are struggling with giveaways, Buffalo might be in trouble. But if things look more like they did over the first 10 weeks of the year, I think Josh Allen and company should be well positioned to make it to 9-3.
Bill Barnwell, we thank you for taking care of the football here on ESPN Daily.
No tanking here, Pablo.
Okay, up next. The U.S. women's soccer team earned a win off the field in their discrimination lawsuit. So Julie Foudy joins the show to explain what all of that means.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Here's another story I want you to know. The U.S. Women's National Team filed its gender discrimination lawsuit against U.S. soccer back in March 2019, which might as well be a century ago. But this month, both sides agreed to resolve at least part of that lawsuit, specifically the part about equal working conditions. So I asked Julie Foudy, a two-time World Cup winner and gold medalist and host of the Laughter Permitted podcast, to tell me what all of this means for her old team.
So what happened is the players and U.S. soccer came to a settlement on the working conditions part of the lawsuit. And so what they actually settled on for working conditions were things like flights, hotels, venues they play at, number of staff members they have, all things that honestly, going back to my days, we've been fighting for a very long time. You may recall back in May, Judge Klossner dismissed the players' equal pay argument. And now that they've cleared the working conditions, it now frees up their ability to appeal the equal pay. So not to diminish what was agreed to. It's huge, but really the equal pay portion is what the women will want to be focused on going forward.
So there is this legal path forward for the larger, bigger picture equal pay lawsuit, as you say. But I also want to understand, Julie, what the fight for improved working conditions looked like back when you were a player. Like, what was it like back then? What were you guys asking for? What were you not getting?
Oh gosh, you're asking me to rewind a long ways, Pablo. But you know, things that to maybe someone on the outside, it's like, yeah, it's not that big a deal. But when you're living in it daily, and for athletes who live in this daily, where you're like,
yeah,
hey, how come we're staying at the Holiday Inn Express? And you look over, and you know, a men's team, for example, is maybe staying at the Ritz-Carlton. It's like, that doesn't seem right. Mm. And then, or why are we traveling middle seats coach forever and we're seeing them fly first class? In the 90s and the early 2000s, right, we were bringing these things up daily. I mean, I remember sending them a photo of us, because back in the day, you didn't have cell phones to send them on. Sending them actually a physical photo to the president of U.S. Soccer, was Hank Steinbrecher at the time. And it was all of us in our red sweatshirts sitting middle row, going back the entire plane. It was like a stripe of red down the middle. And I was like, this is what I'm talking about, right? Coach, middle seats, or we're sitting in the, you know, back then they had smoking sections. We were in the very last row before smoking. So those kind of things that, you know, back in my day in the 90s and the 2000s, were an issue. Obviously, things have gotten better, right? But there were still strides to be made. So it's just closing the gap on those little things, that lowest hanging fruit that should have been closed a long time ago. But again, I think the bigger issue for the women, because they were already getting to some closure on that gap, is now the closure on the equal pay gap.
Just to be clear about what is left on the table in this lawsuit, what else the team is going to be asking for in terms of redressing the discrimination concerns. What else is happening here?
What I think the women want going forward is, and the big outlier in all of this, that is the piece of the puzzle that is really hanging in the balance, is the FIFA money, right? Because U.S. soccer said, we'll pay you what we pay the men, but we can't pay you what FIFA pays the men. Because for example, Pablo, in 2019, when the U.S. women's national team won the World Cup, FIFA gives a bonus for all these things. When you make the World Cup, you get a bonus. When you win a World Cup, you get a bonus. If you make it to the round of 16, you get a bonus. Well, when the women won the World Cup, to win the Women's World Cup, FIFA pays the federation. So U.S. soccer got a bonus of $4 million. Contrast that with the Men's World Cup the year prior in 2018, when the French men's national team won the World Cup in 2018. They got a bonus of $38 million from FIFA. Now, FIFA will say, well, the reason the men get that much more is because we make that much more in the Men's World Cup, which is true. They do. the players on the women's national team will argue, well, that's because of systemic discrimination that has gone back two decades of you not promoting and building the market for the women's team. And that's not on us, right? Mm. And U.S. Soccer just says, look, we cannot make up that bonus because we can't pay the women that bonus because we get that money from FIFA. And we wouldn't get that money from FIFA if the women won.
So this is a fight now that's stretching on probably longer than you guys had hoped. But how optimistic are you, Julie, at the end of this?
I actually am super optimistic. I'm more optimistic than I ever have been in that you have a former player as the president and a female player in Cindy Parlow-Cohn who's lived this, who understands it, who understands the lack of trust, right? And is trying to mend that. You have a new CEO, you have a new legal counsel. So I think there is a shift in that culture. I'm hopeful that they get to a place where the men and the women can finally come together and say, look, let's share the pot evenly. FIFA revenue, gate revenue, sponsorship revenue, TV broadcast rights revenue. So when the women do well, the men get half of that. And when the men do well, the women get half of that. And they share all of the revenues. And then everyone wins, right? We want the men to do well because we share in that. And they want us to do well because they share in that. The Federation wants everyone to do well because they share in that. So I hope, and I'm optimistic that that's where this is leading, because I think it would also save a ton of energy and negativity that doesn't help anyone in the end. And it doesn't certainly help the game in the end.
Julie Foudy, thank you for sharing your positivity with us on ESPN Daily.
We need some good news for 2020, Pablo. Let's get it done before the end.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.